You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us.
Hi, I'm Annie from the US.
And I'm Johanna from Austria, and you are listening to your favorite international podcast. And first of all, you already heard it, Annie is back. How are you?
I'm tired. No, I'm good. I'm good. I am tired, but I'm on the mend. And you did an amazing job while I was out of commission, which of course I knew you would. But I missed you.
I missed you too. And I'm so glad you're back because we're definitely so much better together. Plus, it feels so extremely weird to be talking into the void.
That is always a little bit weird, isn't it? Thank you so much, everybody, all of our listeners, for your support, your lovely messages. We thank you for your reviews, and most of all, we thank you for listening.
And also sorry for not being able to upload an episode last week, but don't worry, there are still 3 weeks in 2021. We made it to the last month of 2021. Can you believe it? Like, another year's over. How the fuck did that happen?
Well, that's time.
We have one thing we need to tell you, though. It's a fresh hell first. We are going to take a 3 week break, a little holiday time, so to say. So the last episode of 2021 will be our Christmas episode on 22nd of December. And the first episode in 2022 will be on 19th of January. And in almost 3 years of doing this, we actually never took a few weeks off. We never had a vacation.
No.
We had in total like 3 weeks without an episode. One of them was last week. And a handful of episodes one of us did alone. But we never took scheduled time off. I'm so excited.
I know.
I'm so looking forward to it. My husband will be home over Christmas and New Year's. We will light the fireplace and watch Christmas movies. I want to do some sewing, and I haven't done that since last winter. It's going to be lovely.
It is. And I'm hoping to read a few books for future topics. So it's nice to have a planned vacation rather than an emergency that's kind of forced us to scramble, you know what I mean?
Like a
planned time off. It's exciting.
All right, let's get into today's episode. It's a great story. It's been on my list for a long time, and a couple of days ago, I was like, in the evening, I could watch some TV, and I realized on Disney Plus, there's the, not the latest Ridley Scott, because I heard House of Gucci is the latest one, but the one before that, The Last Duel, which is about this case that we're going to tell you about today, and I really enjoyed the movie. I will get back to it next week. So Annie and I thought, well, we have been meaning to talk about this for a while now, and there's never a better time than right now. So let's do it. And this will be a two-part episode, because there's just a little bit too much to fit into one episode, right?
Definitely. Today we're going to tell you about a woman who didn't stay quiet when she was the victim of a horrible crime, and how all of this led to one of the last trials by combat in France ever. It's often called the last one, but that's not 100% accurate. But I think you can all understand why this story is right up our alley.
Yeah. The most important source for these two episodes is the book The Last Duel, a true story of trial by combat in medieval France by Eric Jaeger. He's an English professor at UCLA and specialized in medieval literature. And he actually traveled to all the archives in France and looked through the old manuscripts. So it's a great book. I can highly recommend. We also have other sources, and we'll link to them in our album, in our group, as usual. Also, quick content warning, we will be talking about sexual assault.
All right, well, we are entering the way, way back. The way back. So take a seat. I was going to say fasten your seatbelts, but the way back has no seatbelts. So just hang on to whatever you can find, because it's going to be
a bumpy ride.
Yeah, a little bit. I don't think we've actually gone this far. Well, yeah, not in an entire episode, at least. We are going to France in the second half of the 14th century, so the 1370s and the 1380s. You know, the 70s and 80s, but 1300s. Yeah. So it's the ending of the Middle Ages. It's the so-called late Middle Ages or the late medieval period. And on the horizon, you can already sort of see the Renaissance approaching, but we're not there yet. It's still another 100 years before the Middle Ages are officially no more. It would be way, way too much to get into the Middle Ages and how that was like in France. That's a whole podcast on its own with dozens of seasons. But let's just say it was a time of constantly changing borders and constantly changing rulers. See, Johanna, this is one of those times where we're like, but we're not going to tell you everything. So yeah, so many things happened in the Middle Ages in Europe. The Great Schism, which splits up the Roman Catholic Church from the Eastern Orthodox Church. There was the Walk to Canossa. The Magna Carta was signed. The plague swept across Europe several times. There's a time when there are two popes, one in Rome, one in Avignon, for a short while at the end of the Western Schism. There were even three men simultaneously claiming to be pope. And that, again, too many popes. It's too many. And the fighting, there was just, it was a lot of fighting, too much war, so many battles. The Muslim conquest of Europe in the 8th century, that lasted until the 10th century, and then the Christian Crusades to conquer what was considered the Holy Land. And then, of course, there was Genghis Khan, who was just conquering, you know, anything he could get his hands on, really.
Fun fact, today there are 16 million people alive who are descendants of Genghis Khan. That's just like in Europe. Allegedly, most people are somehow related to Jean Mon.
Yeah, I'm one of them.
Fascinating stuff. Really?
Yeah, through the Plantagenet line. I'm a Plantagenet and was able... It's only because I'm really into the ancestry, but if you are related to somebody of note, it's really easy to trace because those records were kept. So if you are finding a line easy to trace, keep going because you'll probably end up with somebody notable. Notable enough to have made, you know, notations of all the children and that kind of thing. So, yeah, shout out to my millions of fam listening. There's a lot of Charlemagne. So, yeah, it wasn't only the different religions and cultures being at war with each other. There was also a lot of inner European fighting going on. So in 1066, the Norman William and his army crossed the Channel, invaded England, and defeated the Anglo-Saxon king Harold at the Battle of Hastings, making William the first Norman king of England, King William I, or, as he is more commonly known, William the Conqueror, also related to him.
Which means you're also related to the queen.
Yes. More distantly, though, because I break when the... Anyway, again, oversimplifications, but we could talk about this for hours and only scratch the surface. And we're not a history podcast. I mean, we dabble, but that's not really what we're here for.
There are so much better people for that out there to listen to.
Yes, there are. Definitely. Just know that William kept longing for his Normandy homeland all his life. And all of this started a feud between England and France that would last for centuries to come. It pretty much was the reason for the Hundred Years' War, which was not really a 100-year-long war, but a series of battles and armed conflicts that centered exactly around the French and English conflict. And that lasted from 1337 until 1453, when it unofficially ended at the Battle of Castillon. Officially, the war lasted roughly 20 years longer, and it was also not the last time that France and England would be at war with each other. Side note, one of the most prominent people of the 100 Years' War period is definitely Jeanne d'Arc, the Maid of Orleans. And I've been to the site in Rouen where Joan of Arc was burned at the stake. It's near the most charming children's carousel. So if you're in Rouen with small children, take them by the carousel and also check out where she was burned alive. There's a nice monument. I love Europe. You don't find those kind of things together here. Here it's more like live bait and laundry, you know, whereas in Europe you get like Joan of Arc was burned at the stake here. Also enjoy this children's carousel. Okay. Now, there's a reason I'm telling you all of this, and it's not really important for our story, but it gives you an idea of who these people were that we're going to be talking about, because this was their day-to-day life, and this was what formed them and sort of what made them, in a way.
Yeah, because most of our story, except for a few sidesteps to Paris, this is taking place in northwest of France, in Normandy, and to be exact, at Castle Carouge. What is nowadays a lovely chateau was, of course, back then, a burg. The Castle Carouge was home to the noble family Carouge, minor nobility, but nobility. And the family name Carouge has actually a pretty interesting story, or better, it's an interesting lore of how they came to be. So, way back in the family tree, there was a Count Ralph, who was married, but had started an affair with a very powerful sorceress. When the Countess found out about the affair, she took a dagger and murdered her husband, the cheating Count, and maybe even the sorceress. Or not. The story is very vague when it comes to that part. But the sorceress cursed the Countess and her offsprings for the murder, or the possible double murder. The next day, a red mark appeared on the Countess's face. But even with the, you know, Count being murdered and the Countess now having this huge red mark on her face all of a sudden, nobody suspected the Countess of being the murderer. Everybody was just like, whoa, what a weird coincidence. Anyway, what's for dinner? And they moved on with their lives. Soon after, the Countess realized that she was in fact pregnant and she gave birth to a son who she named Karl. Everything was fine until the boy turned 7 and the same mysterious mark appeared on his face, which gave him the nickname Karl Rouge that later would be mangled into Karl Rouge. Rouge is French for red. And for the next 7 generations, all firstborn boys would have the same mark on their face once they turned 7. After those 7 generations, the sorceress was either satisfied or she really grew tired of the whole thing and, you know, no more signs appeared on the faces of the Karl Rouge heirs. And I said the Karl Rouge were a minor noble family, but they could live comfortably in the often very harsh environment of Normandy. They were absolutely loyal to the French king, whoever that was over the centuries, of course, and defended the French throne through many English attacks, and of course also participated in many French campaigns against the English. Medieval society was set up like a pyramid, which is not so different from our society. The base, with 95%, was made of peasants, then came clergy, and on top the noble families, and of course the one who reigns over all of them, the king. The nobility itself was again shaped like a pyramid. On top the king, under him the higher-ranking noblemen, the dukes, the counts, then the barons, and so on. And on the very bottom were the knights, and under them the squires. And every step of the pyramid was a vassal to the ones above them. So the counts swore loyalty to the king, the knights were vassals to the noblemen above them, and so on.
And we have a quick explanation. This is from Britannica.com. Quote, vassal in feudal society, one invested with a fief in return for services to an overlord. Some vassals did not have fiefs and lived at their lord's court as his household knights. Certain vassals who held their fiefs directly from the crown were tenants in chief and formed the most important feudal group, the barons. There were female vassals as well. Their husbands fulfilled their wives' services. Under the feudal contract, the lord had the duty to provide the fief for his vassal, to protect him and to do him justice in his court. And in return, the lord had the right to demand the services attached to the fief and a right to various incomes known as feudal incidents. Examples of incidents are relief, a tax paid when a fief was transferred to an heir or alienated by the vassal, and scutage, a tax paid in lieu of military service. The vassal owed fealty to his lord. A breach of this duty was a felony regarded as so heinous an offense that in England all serious crimes, even those that had nothing to do with feudalism proper, came to be called felonies, since, in a way, they were breaches of the fealty owed to the king as guardian of the public peace and order. That's a really interesting bit of information about where the word felony comes from, isn't it?
So good, or?
So, continuing to quote, the vassal's rights over the fiefs grew larger and larger in the course of time, and soon fiefs became hereditary in the sense that investiture could not be withheld from an heir who was willing to do homage. The rules of inheritance tended to safeguard an undivided fief and preferred the eldest among the sons. This principle was far from absolute. Under pressure from younger sons, parts of an inheritance might be set apart for them in compensation. Vassals also acquired the right to alienate their fiefs with the proviso first of the lord's consent and later on payment of a certain tax. Similarly, they obtained the right to subinfeudate, that is, to become lords themselves by granting parts of their fiefs to vassals of their own. If a vassal died without heir or committed a felony, his fief went back to the lord.
It's kind of a pyramid scheme.
It's...
in a way.
Yeah. It's... there's a joke there about trickle-down economics, but I'm too tired. Yeah, this is all sort of important, though, to understand certain aspects of this story. And it's basically just a society, like you said, not that dissimilar to ours, where 95% of people were really working very hard and struggling to keep their heads above water for the 5% who were doing just fine.
I mean, but even in the 5%, there were really huge differences.
Yeah. So, as we said, the family Carouge had sworn allegiance to the kings of France, and in particular to the Counts of Perche, and worked their way up to some decent pieces of land and a few prestigious positions. Sir Jean de Carouge III was not only rewarded with knighthood for his service during early campaigns of the 100 Years' War, but he was also the commander of Belem, a very important position that made him responsible to defend the vital position of the castle Belem against attackers. Jean III was married to Nicole de Bouchard, and together they had three children. Jean IV, the eldest and heir to the family land, he was born sometime in the late 1330s. And then there was another son who joined the clergy and became very influential as an archbishop, and then a daughter who couldn't carry on the family name. So what good was she? I mean, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, for obvious reasons, because she would sooner or later be married off. So the plight to carry on the family Carouge's name was in the hands of Jean de Carouge IV. He was a brave man, a fighter, loyal, stubborn, often somewhat grumpy, distant, and not much of a talker. Some would say a typical Normand back in the day. And as Jean was a soldier who could possibly die in the battlefield at any time, he needed a male heir ASAP to carry on the family legacy. So when he was in his early 30s, he married Jeanne de Tilly, a daughter of the Count de Chambois. Jeanne was not only young and fertile, she also came with a very generous dowry, which helped Jean to further strengthen his family's influence. Soon after the wedding, Jeanne de Tilly got pregnant, and indeed, 9 months later, a healthy son was born. Now, the child needed a godfather, and if you think choosing a godparent is serious business nowadays, it was so much more important in the noble families of medieval times.
So this is what ThoughtCo.com has to say about medieval baptism. Quote, "The primary purpose of baptism was to wash away original sin and drive all evil from the newborn child. So important was this sacrament to the Catholic Church that the usual opposition to women performing sacerdotal duties was overcome for fear an infant might die unbaptized. Midwives were authorized to perform the rite if the child was unlikely to survive and there was no man nearby to do it. If the mother died in childbirth, the midwife was supposed to cut her open and extract the baby so that she could baptize it. Baptism had another significance. It welcomed a new Christian soul into the community. The rite conferred a name on the infant that would identify him throughout his life, however short it might be. The official ceremony in the church would establish lifelong ties to his godparents, who were not supposed to be related to their godchild through any blood or marriage link. Thus, from the very beginning of his life, the medieval child had a relationship to the community beyond that defined by kinship. The role of godparents was mainly spiritual. They were to teach their godchild his prayers and instruct him in faith and morals. The relationship was considered as close as a blood link, and marriage to one's godchild was prohibited. Because godparents were expected to bestow gifts on their godchild, there was some temptation to designate many godparents. So the number had been limited by the church to three: a godmother and two godfathers for a son, a godfather and two godmothers for a daughter. Great care was taken when selecting prospective godparents. They might be chosen from among the parents' employers, guild members, friends, neighbors, or lay clergy. No one from a family that the parents hoped or planned to marry the child into would be asked. That's really interesting, I think. Generally, at least one of the godparents would be of a higher social status than the parent. A child was usually baptized on the day he was born. The mother would stay at home, not only to recuperate, but because the church generally followed the Jewish custom of keeping women from holy places for several weeks after giving birth. The father would assemble the godparents, and together with the midwife, they would all bring the child to the church. This procession would frequently include friends and relatives and could be quite festive. The priest would meet the baptismal party at the church door. Here he would ask if the child had been baptized yet and whether it was a boy or a girl. Next, he would bless the baby, put salt in its mouth to represent the reception of wisdom, and exorcise any demons. Then, he would test the godparents' knowledge of the prayers they were expected to teach the child. God, unexpected quizzes! The Paternoster, the Credo, and the Ave Maria. Now the party entered the church and proceeded to the baptismal font. The priest would anoint the child, immerse him in the font, and name him. One of the godparents would raise the baby up from the water and wrap him in a christening gown. The gown was made of white linen and might be decorated with seed pearls. Less wealthy families might use a borrowed one. The last part of the ceremony took place at the altar, where the godparents made the profession of faith for the child. The participants would then all return to the parents' house for a feast. The entire procedure of baptism mustn't have been a pleasant one for the newborn. Removed from the comfort of its home, not to mention its mother's breast, this is my favorite bit of this article, and carried out into the cold, cruel world, having salt shoved in its mouth, immersed in water that could be dangerously cold in winter, all of this must have been a jarring experience. But for the family, the godparents, friends, and even the community at large, the ceremony heralded the arrival of a new member of society. From the trappings that went with it, it was an occasion that appears to have been a welcome one. End quote. I have a lot of Monty Python songs going on in my head right now. That's all I'm going to say about that.
But I think it's a given that you wouldn't choose just some rando to be a godfather.
Yeah, but it surprises me that like you wouldn't choose somebody that you might marry into. Do you know what I mean? So you wouldn't choose...
I think that's because they wanted to, you know, extend. If you get married to the family, you're already then connected to them. But if you have extra, yeah, like, you know, they had their fingers in all the pots.
Yes. Yes.
And nowadays, you also can have a godparent. My godmother is my aunt, so we're blood related. There's no big deal anymore nowadays.
Yeah, my godmother and godfather are my aunt and uncle, so same. Yeah. And, of course, Jean de Carrouges had thought long and hard about who would be the perfect godfather for his firstborn child and heir to his name, and he finally decided that his dear friend and fellow vassal to the Count de Perche, the squire Jacques Legris, would be a good choice. Jean and Jacques had known each other for a while. Not only did they both serve the Count de Perche, their estates were not too far from each other, and they both had a colorful family name, Rouge, which of course is red, and Gris, which was gray. But that's pretty much where the commonalities stopped, because while Jean was an introvert, Jacques was outgoing and charming. Jean could probably barely read and write. Jacques was educated in both. Jacques was a womanizer. It didn't bother him that he was married, of course. I mean, come on. And many considered him to be handsome. Jean knew his way around a battlefield, while Jacques knew his way around the court. And so Jacques Legris, whose father, Guillaume Legris, had never advanced beyond being a squire, pretty quickly made himself a name at the court of Count Pierre de Perche, who was a cousin to the French king Charles VI. Jacques became one of Pierre's favorites and closest confidants. Jacques apparently did even lend money to the Count when it was needed. To show his thanks and appreciation, Count Pierre de Perche gifted Jacques Legris a very nice estate and piece of land called Arnoux-les-Faucons. Jacques was also awarded the position of captain of the castle at Exmes. Pierre even took Jacques to Paris to introduce the squire to his cousin, King Charles VI. Soon, everybody who was somebody knew Jacques Legris. And while Jacques was living his best life, making friends in high places, Jean de Carrouges was not so lucky. His wife Jeanne died, and soon after, his only child passed away as well. So now he was once more without a wife, but even worse for him, he was once more without an heir. So, in between battles, he managed to find a new bride, and her name was Marguerite de Thibauville. She was the daughter of a very controversial man, Robert de Thibauville. He was controversial because he was considered a traitor to the French crown. Twice he had sided with the English and against the French king in some territorial battle or another.
Yeah, it's a wonder that this man was still alive. I have no idea how he managed to do that, but he was pretty much shunned at the French courts. That's the reason why he was willing to give his daughter Marguerite to Jean de Carrouges. As we already know, the Carrouges were absolutely loyal to the French throne, and Robert de Thibauville hoped that the allegiance between the two families would restore the name. Jean de Carrouges wanted Marguerite because she was young and hopefully very fertile. He was in his 40s, Marguerite had just turned 18, and she came with, again, a very generous dowry, just like his first wife, Jeanne de Tilly. Marguerite and Shaw married in 1380, and that's when things between Shaw and his friend Jacques started to go south. Because the trouble started immediately with Marguerite's dowry. Remember the generous gift in the form of a piece of land that Count Pierre had given to Jacques? Well, it turned out that this piece of land, Anneau-le-Faucon, used to belong to Robert de Thibauville, Marguerite's father. It should have been part of her dowry, but Robert had sold it to the Count Pierre de Perche in 1377, so 3 years before the wedding of Jean and Marguerite. Jean was furious, and because he was stubborn and wanted what he thought was his right, he began a legal battle against Pierre. Remember, Jean was actually his vassal, and now he was starting a lawsuit against his lord. The whole thing dragged on for months, and in the end, Pierre had to travel to Paris to meet with his cousin, remember, the King of France, to have the thing settled. Jacques Legris was able to keep the land, and Jean was now really side-eyed whenever he appeared at Pierre's court in Argentan. Jean secretly, or not so secretly, blamed Jacques Legris for the outcome of his lawsuit. Next, Jean's father died. Remember, he had the position of commander of Belém, and Jean expected to inherit this position from his father. This was not a given, but it was usually what happened. Not in this instance, though. Count Pierre, still probably pretty annoyed with Jean, gave the position to another man. No, not Jacques, but Jean still blamed Jacques for this as well. Because Jacques held a similar position in another castle, so that made Jean jealous. His former friend, now foe, did not deserve such a rank, while he, the son of Jean de Carrouges III, Viscount de Belém, was not allowed to follow in his father's footsteps. And there was also a third incident. Jean purchased some land that actually belonged to Count Pierre. Remember, because before we talked about how if a vassal would die without leaving an heir, their fief would go back to the lord. And so this was one of those cases. Jean had purchased land that was actually supposed to go back to Pierre. Now, Jean had to return the land, he got his money back, but still he felt ignored and even a little bit ridiculed. And surely, this horrible Jacques Legris was behind all of Jean's misfortune.
Yeah, clearly. Clearly, this was all someone else's fault. There's so much, like, fragile male issues. Okay. And now Jean and his young wife are sitting in his medieval castle de Carrouges. It's cold, it's drafty, Jean is grumpy, and he just bitches and moans about Jacques and Pierre once in a while. He leaves to participate in some battle, and then he comes back, and he's complaining again. And that's kind of Marguerite's life for a while. Ugh. They don't socialize much, they don't have many visitors, and they don't get a lot of invitations because Jean is sort of persona non grata right now, right? Marguerite is a young woman, still childless, and I'm sure she would have loved to leave the castle once in a while to meet some other people. And then one day, the couple gets invited to a baptism at a nearby castle. And Jean actually agrees to go and to take his young and very beautiful wife with him. The only reason why he actually agreed to go was he was pretty certain that he would not meet a certain someone at that castle. But, boy, was he wrong. It's a problem. Okay, so Jean and Marguerite, they arrive at the festivities and they walk into the courtyard. And who does Jean see? Yeah, that's right. It's Jacques Legris. Scandal.
Oh mon Dieu.
La mon Dieu. So the two enemies lock eyes and Jacques is starting to make his way over and the chatter stops and now everyone is watching them. And Marguerite, she's like me. She's like, I don't have any idea what's going on. What's even happening? She's never even met Jacques, so she has no idea who this tall, dark-haired guy even is, right? Jean and Jacques are now standing right in front of each other when all of a sudden one offers the other a handshake. Was it Jean or was it Jacques? Nobody knows anymore. Who can say? All we know is that the two greet each other as if nothing ever happened. And the crowd is legitimately cheering.
And then everybody clapped.
Yeah, everyone's just clapping because they've shook hands. Then Jean turns to his young wife and tells her to give his old friend Jacques a kiss on the mouth to prove to him how dear he is to the house de Carrouges. So, can you imagine for a moment that for years on end, you've had to listen to your curmudgeon of a husband bitch about how horrible this person is, and then the first time you meet, you're ordered to kiss him on the mouth? No, thank you. Well, we can assume that Jacques Legris was pretty impressed with the beautiful Marguerite. I mean,
who wouldn't?
What's not to love?
Oh, yeah.
So, it's now 1385, and the French crown is planning a new campaign. They are sending 3,000 soldiers to Scotland to support the Scottish troops and raid northern England. And Jean de Carrouge decides to join this campaign.
It's pretty interesting how things worked back then if you were a vassal and were called to join some campaign. It's not like your king gave you anything up front. You had to provide your own horses, your own weapons, your own armor, provisions for the journey. So you had to invest quite some money up front to prepare yourself for the battle that you fought for someone else. And if you returned, you received your pay. The amount of money you got was depending on your rank, of course. For a knight in the 100 Years' War that was 1 livre per day, for example, it was not too bad, but it was also definitely not enough to make it worth risking your life.
Yeah, I don't think it was even heirloom carpet money. I mean,
was it horse money?
It might have been horse money, but not heirloom carpet money.
Sometimes it wasn't even enough to break even with your investment. And that's where the plundering comes into play. If you were successful and won, you could take valuables you found in the houses and strong keeps, for example. You could carry off some coins, gold, silver, whatever you found. And that's how you could actually make a fortune as a knight. If you lost, but at least were able to stay alive and return home, it was not unheard of that you returned with quite some debt.
Yeah.
So I talked to my husband about this because I found it so interesting. And you know that my husband is a soldier, and I asked him how he would feel if that was still the case for him today. He often has very interesting points of view that I most of the time don't think of. And he said, well, if that's not the most motivational thing for any soldier, I don't know what is. And I asked him, okay, what exactly do you mean by that? And he was like, okay, imagine if you're off fighting some pointless war for your king and you get nothing out of it. If your side wins or loses doesn't make too much of a difference, you know, but you have to fight anyway because you swore your allegiance. And not only do you have to pay so much money up front, you also get very little pay. But if you destroy the enemy, you can come home with fortune and fame. And so this isn't just like, okay, let's make it out of here a life situation for the knights anymore, because probably most wouldn't play it safe. It's better to die in battle than coming home empty-handed. And I think he's not wrong. He has a point there.
Sure.
I think that's how many of them must have felt, especially those from minor nobility with not a lot of family wealth to fall back to, right?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say there's a lot of parallels in our modern military, though. Like, the vast majority are like us, right? With no family wealth to fall back on. So I'm glad the stakes aren't quite so high anymore.
Yeah, but at least it's not BYOT, so bring your own tank nowadays.
Right.
Can you imagine?
But before Jean de Carrouge boarded a ship that would bring him to the Scottish shore, he took Marguerite to stay with her father. He didn't want her to be without a man at home to protect her. And I can hear the collective eye roll, we get it. But that was not actually that bad of an idea. It was unsafe times, it wasn't unheard of that marauders, deserters, and other criminals were roaming the Normandy countryside, and wouldn't think twice about attacking a woman left alone. We just got into how important the plundering was, right? Plunder, plunder, plunder. Well, it worked everywhere. So, of course, she still had servants with her at home, but still, better to stay with family during this, like, unsafe time period. So, Marguerite is with her family, and Jean is off fighting in Scotland. Now, the Scottish campaign did not go as planned. First of all, the Scots were not thrilled about having the French soldiers there because no one had really asked for them. They just kind of showed up, and the Scots were like, we're fine, we can fight our own battles. So the French didn't get a lot of support, not in battle and not in between battles. There was almost no food, not for them, not for their horses. Many French soldiers died of starvation or disease. In the winter of 1385, what's left of the French troops board the ships and return home. Many were very sick and weak, and many were completely bankrupt. The only good thing that came out of this debacle of a war campaign was that Jean was knighted as a reward for his bravery. And Jean returns as well, and he is very sick and running a high fever. He picks up his wife, and together they ride to Cap-o-Misnil, where Jean's mother resides. He tells Marguerite he has to leave again for a couple weeks because he has to go to Paris to pick up his salary from the Scottish campaign. Marguerite will stay with her mother-in-law at the small castle at Cap-au-Mesnil. Before Jean leaves, he tells Marguerite and his mother that Marguerite's maid has to stay by her side at all times, and under no circumstance is she to be left alone. And off he goes. Going to Paris on a horse is roughly a week's trip, maybe even longer. Nowadays, the distance is 400 kilometers or 248 miles, but back then, you had to follow the antique Roman streets that would take you to Paris. On his way, Jean stops at Argentan, at the residence of his lord, Count Pierre de Perche. Not that Jean really wanted to, and not that he was expected at court, but it was the polite thing to do once you had returned from a campaign, to report back for duty with your lord. So Jean walks into the castle and is announced to Pierre, and of course, Jacques Legris is there as well. Now, we don't know what happened in this meeting, but something might have happened, because Jean and Jacques are now, once again, enemies.
Okay, so now Jean is on his way to Paris. This means he will at least be gone for 2.5 to 3 weeks. And Jacques hears that Jean's young and very pretty wife is staying with her mother-in-law at Cap-au-Mesnil. And so he sends his servant, Adam Louvel, to Cap-au-Mesnil. Louvel owned a house there not far from the castle, and he was instructed to keep an eye on the castle and its inhabitants, and if he saw or heard something interesting, he was to inform his master immediately. And after a couple of days, Adam Louvel indeed hears something interesting. He learns that Marguerite's mother-in-law will leave the castle for half a day, and she will take all the servants with her. Marguerite will be left alone at home. Jacques hatches a plan. The day comes, Marguerite's mother-in-law has some business in a nearby town that she has to take care of, and for whatever reason, she takes all the servants with her. Even the maid that was instructed to never leave Marguerite's side has to go with Lady Nicole de Carrouges. Just one other maid is left behind, but she is taking care of some chores, Lord knows where on the grounds. It's January, so Marguerite is sitting in front of the fireplace when she hears loud knocking on the door. Marguerite is careful, and so she just opens the little sliding window in the door to see who is knocking. It's Adam Louvel. Marguerite knows him because he lives nearby. And when she asks him what he wants, he tells her that it's cold outside and asks to come in so that he can tell her. And because Marguerite knows this man and because she has a kind heart and doesn't want him to be freezing out there, she opens the door. Adam enters, but he's not alone, because waiting out of sight was Jacques Legris. Jacques bolts the entrance door behind him and takes off his cape. He tells Marguerite that he loves her and that he can't stop thinking about her ever since he saw her at the festivity last year. He would do everything for her. Marguerite is shocked and tells him to stop. How dare he speak to her like this? Legris is confused. Usually this kind of smooth talking is enough to charm the ladies at court. He grabs her wrist and forces her to sit down on a bench next to him. He now tells her that he knows her husband has financial troubles. He is offering money in exchange for sex. Marguerite is now even more in shock. She tells the man to leave her house immediately, but they don't move. Marguerite screams, cries for help, but no one can hear her. She tries to run, but Jacques and Adam catch her. One grabs her arms, the other one holds her by her waist, and together they half carry, half pull her to the bedroom, where they throw her on the bed. Jacques orders Adam Louvel to leave the room. He is sure that Marguerite will not put up much of a fight, but he's wrong. Marguerite fights as hard as she can. At one point, she even manages to break free and makes a sprint to the window. But Jacques Legris catches her before she can open it. He calls out for Adam Louvel, who comes back into the room. Together, the two men tie Marguerite to the bed and gag her. And now Adam Louvel stands next to the bed and watches his master as he rapes Marguerite de Carrouges. Once it's over, they untie her, and Jacques warns her to never speak a word about what just happened, as it can cost her her life.
And it's not only a threat that he would kill her, it's more of a warning that her husband could kill her for this. Because in many cases, the rapist would not be blamed, but the women. Did you fight back hard enough? Did you yell for help? Did you try to run? Did you provoke this? I wish I could say that we left this kind of thinking in the Middle Ages, but it still happens today, and here we are. So, a week or so later, Jean returns from Paris, and he finds his wife being very quiet and pale, and not her usual self. He thinks there must have been some fight between his wife and his mother, but once Jean and Marguerite retire to their bedroom, Marguerite tells him the whole story of what had happened to her. Jean is furious, and he swears revenge, and together, the couple decides what to do next. You have to know several things. Rape, especially raping a noblewoman, was actually considered a horrible crime, but it was a crime that was extremely hard to prove, as usually there were no witnesses around. Also, it was not considered a crime against the woman. The victim in rape cases was the male guardian, so the father, the husband, the closest male relative. This was more like property damage, right? And a woman couldn't just accuse her rapist and take him to court herself. She needed a male guardian to do all of this for her. So we can only imagine how many women just stayed quiet and never spoke of what was done to them, especially back then. But not Marguerite. She was not going to take this. The very next day, Jean had his closest friends and family gather at Castle de Carouge, and he and Marguerite told everyone about the rape. And I just can't imagine how brave she was. Can you imagine sitting there in front of your family and friends and neighbors and telling them all the intimate details about what had happened to you? But she did it. And they asked questions. They wanted to know the details because what if she was lying? What if she actually had an affair with Legree? But Marguerite didn't sway. She stood strong and kept insisting that Jacques Legree had raped her. Now, the first step was to take legal action against Legree, but there was one big problem. The judge would be their lord, Count Pierre de Perche. Now, we all know that Jacques was his favorite and that he would never decide against him. Marguerite and Jean knew this too, and so they didn't even bother to attend the trial. Of course, Jacques Legree was acquitted, and Count Pierre decided that Marguerite must have dreamt the attack.
I think this is a good moment to end this week's episode.
Yeah.
At least we are not really leaving you with a cliffhanger, I'd say. Next week we will tell you all about how they managed to get a trial by combat. It's so exciting. And how it all ended.
Yeah. There's a lot to talk about. It's exciting.
Do you have something good?
I do have something good. Yeah. You, first of all, for handling everything with this surgery. It's funny because there have been, this is probably the 10th time that I've had a situation where I've said, well, I have to undergo all these scans and then they're going to tell me if I need surgery. And then I've done this so many times that I honestly didn't think I was going to need the surgery. I was kind of like, well, we'll just see. It's going to be fine. So when they were suddenly like, yeah, you're having surgery next month, it was like, oh, okay. So it was like a little bit planned, but also not even a little bit planned, you know, and it had to happen. And I'm grateful for the care that I had. And I'll talk more about that in a Patreon thing. But I really want to thank you, obviously, for handling everything here while I was out of commission. And my family, especially Paul, who has been waiting on me hand and foot. And also my doctors and nurses. I ended up having a kind of scary first night. I developed a post-op bleed and needed a blood transfusion and had a couple of scary moments. And my care was just really exceptional. So thanks to Beth Israel and also my nurses, especially Diana and Kelly, if you're listening. Thank you, thank you, thank you for all of your very gentle and tender care with me. I really appreciate it so, so much. So, yeah.
My something good is, first of all, that you're back because I really missed you.
I missed you.
But also, I have another something good. Snow and our wood-burning oven. Last week it started snowing, and I have to add that where I live now is actually a bit more mild climate than in other Austrian regions. We are the wine region for a reason. But it started in the morning with icy rain, and I was like, ugh, seriously, ice rain now, thanks. But soon after it turned into beautiful snowflakes, and actually a lot of snow fell, at least a lot for here, and it stayed like this for 3 days. And so I went and fired up the fireplace.
You have like a wood-burning stove.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Jem and Lila were sleeping in front of the fire, and I started decorating the house a little bit. It made me really happy. So yeah, snow and a nice fire are my something good.
I love it. I haven't done that much. Dad and Moose came for Thanksgiving, so that was really good. And Moose went out with Paul to get a Christmas tree the day after. And so she picked a really good one. It's up. We haven't decorated it. Hopefully this coming weekend, when I'm hoping reaching and stretching will be a little easier. For me right now, it's silly little things where you're like, oh, nope, still can't do that yet, but I'm getting there. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that. Thank you so much for listening. We really, really appreciate it.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of our other episodes, or maybe all the episodes, please do us a huge favor and go to your podcast app and check if you can leave us a rating and or review. You have no idea how much it helps us. It's a way to support us.
It really is. If you want any information on where to listen to us, how to get in touch with us, what our P.O. box is, you can find all of that on our webpage, which is freshhellpodcast.com. And our email you can reach us at is freshhellpodcast@gmail.com. We also have an amazing Facebook group. They are so helpful. They gave me the nicest list. We came up with such a good list of stuff I should pack for the hospital. I didn't get to do any of it, but it was a really good list. I've saved it for next time. Yeah, they're such a good group. They're the best. Thank you.
Please, as always, tell your pets we said hi, the dogs, the cats, the guinea pigs, the hamsters, the mice, the snakes, the opossums, the wallabies, the fish, the creepy crawlies birds. I'm not going to mention. The birds, yeah. All the birds, yeah. What's with the birds? There's not a lot of birds photos in our pets thread, so...
That's true. We do have a lot of people in Australia, though, that post the most amazing pictures of just, like, cockatiels and kookaburras on their balconies. It's like paradise over there. I'm coming for you one day, Australia, so help me.
Give them a hug, give them a cuddle, give them a treat. Also, not only be super, super awesome to your pets, also be kind of nice to your fellow human beings. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Everybody's super stressed. The holidays are coming and, you know, it's a lot. People are... weird, but, you know, they try their best as well.
Everybody's weird and tired, but we're just doing the best we can. That's so true. And if, like many of us, you're going through hell right now,
keep going. Tschüss.
Bye-bye.